UFP, the United Federation of Podcasts.
Welcome to Franchise Fatigue, the little podcast on the United Federation of Podcast Network, where your hosts go through movies, remakes, and sequels. I'm your host, Brandon Shea Mutella, and joining me, as always, is my long-lost brother, Zach Moore.
Yep, going back to that trope, Brandon. There it is.
There it is, right
off
the
bat. They found a way to keep it going. So.
They found a way. Excellent. Right on. Well, we are discussing Scream 3, leading up to our coverage of Scream. But I thought we already covered Scream.
Yeah, that is odd.
It is odd.
But how many times have we covered Halloween?
Three.
Three?
Yeah. Is it maybe something like that? I don't know. I lost count. Too many times. Awesome. Well, Zach, I saw this in theaters as well.
Okay. Did you like this more than Scream 2 when you saw it?
Yes.
Okay, explain yourself. Well, I guess that's what our conversation will be.
That's what our whole conversation. You want me to jump into that right now? Slow down, buddy. How about the trivia?
I do have some trivia. Okay. So, Kevin Williamson, who wrote the first two movies, he was unavailable to return for the third film because he had scheduling conflicts with Dawson's Creek, The Faculty, and Halloween H2O 20 years later. So, that's where these franchises start to have some overlap, I guess. And then he was also directing Teaching Mrs. Tingle, but he wrote an outline for the film. And then Aaron Kruger basically threw this out and wrote a totally new film. That was not a good rewrite because apparently a lot of the characters didn't resemble their characters from the last two films. So Wes Craven himself, director, returning for this, did some rewrites. Mm-hmm. Now, there were a lot of original ideas they had for this that didn't make it to the final version. Matthew Lillard, you know, one of the ghost faces from the first movie, said that he was supposed to come back as the main bad guy in the third one.
Which one is he? What, the crazy one or the boyfriend?
He was the crazy one.
Crazy one, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mom and Dad, they're going to be so bad. A Shaggy from Scooby-Doo. Shaggy. So. Oh, yeah, and you know what? And Michelle Geller was in the Scooby-Doo movies, too. So, man, these are all connected. So, but there's only two of those, Brandon, so we don't have to talk about them. Don't worry. Okay. Until they make a remake, we have to. So, but he was going to have survived having the TV fall on him in Scream, I guess, and was going to orchestrate new ghost face attacks from prison on high school students, and then ultimately targeting Sydney. Hmm. Now, the Columbine shooting happened a few months before production was going to begin on Scream 3, so they scrapped that entirely and didn't bring back his character, and they didn't want to have any sort of, you know, connection. They were just going to avoid all high school violence going on there.
Okay, makes sense.
But also because of the Columbine shooting, the producers were pressured into toning down the film's violence. So there's that, and the complaints of the first two movies were too bloody.
Who the hell is complaining that those two movies are too bloody?
I don't know, right? So Wes Craven was like, come on, like, this is a Scream movie. So they had a compromise that they would still have killings. They would be mostly bloodless. And that kind of shows. And there's more of a comedic and satirical slant to this one than the first two, which I definitely could tell a different vibe here. And that was part of it. So. Mm-hmm. Also, a difference between the first two is Sydney is not in this movie that much. So Neve Campbell's contract allowed her to only have 20 days to work on this movie, which is why she has less screen time. And the reason
screen
why...
Screen time. Less screen time.
Screen time. That should have been the counter this time. Screen time. But she was shooting a movie called Drowning Mona, and then also Party of Five.
Never heard of it.
Me neither. And in Drowning Mona, her character had long streaked hair, so when she played Sydney again here, she required 2 hours of makeup and wig work before she went to set. So which is really annoying. It's like you're playing basically, you know, someone who looks just like you, but you have to do 2 hours of makeup. That's rough. So David Arquette and Courtney Cox, they had met on the set of Scream. They were dating while shooting Scream 2, and they got married a month before production started, or principal photography started, on Scream 3, and they actually cut their honeymoon short to get back to film Scream 3, which is good, because basically this movie is all about them.
Yes, I'm glad they did. I'm glad they did that.
So this is funny to me. So Terry Hatcher was considered for the role of Jennifer Jolie, who went to Parker Posey, who was the actress playing Gale's character, right? There's like 6 degrees of separation on this, because Courtney Cox, everybody was like saying that she should play Lois Lane, right, in a movie. Terry Hatcher played Lois Lane on Lois and Clark, the TV show in the 90s. The producer calls Gale Lois Lane later in the movie, and then Parker Posey, who played Jennifer, ends up being in Superman Returns. Not as Lois Lane, but as a different character. So I thought that was interesting. But I would love to see Terry Hatcher in this. That would have been fantastic. Patrick Dempsey, who plays one of the detectives, most people would know him from Grey's Anatomy these days. He was hired one day before shooting began, and he had one night to learn 3 big dialogue-heavy scenes. So good on him. And speaking of Grey's Anatomy, Scott Foley, who is Sydney's brother in this, he worked on Grey's Anatomy with Patrick Dempsey later on. And this is Scott Foley's feature film debut. Although Benicio del Toro was considered for the role of Roman Bridger, who was Scott Foley's character, that would have been so much better. Scott Foley is my least favorite part of this movie. I do not like him at all. I did not like his character, and then I really didn't like his character. Like, I was like, good, I'm glad that guy's dead. He was annoying. He just felt the most, like, all these other, I don't know, he felt very inauthentic. We'll talk about it, but.
I love that line of his, though, where he's like, I'm next. He's like, why do you think you're next? He holds up that award. He's like, you don't think this is a message?
That is his best moment. Just the accidental breaking of his award. That is pretty funny. Actress who played Maureen Prescott, Lynn McRae, she actually got to play the part this time. She was just in photos, right, in the first couple movies. And she did the voice, and she did that dream. That dream is weird. Is that weird to you?
It felt like a horror movie dream.
Yeah, it's all right. I feel like the first two movies wouldn't have done that. That was more like, I don't know, they felt more like a skit, but I don't know. But those pictures of her, of Maureen as Rena Reynolds, right? Those are actually pictures of Lynn McRae when she was, you know, modeling and headshots and really in her career. So that was pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Jamie Lee Curtis was offered the role of Bianca Burnett, turned it down, and it went to Carrie Fisher. That makes a lot of sense. Like that... You know, that role, like, being...
That really works as Carrie Fisher. I think that scene works amazing.
That's a fun scene, but yeah. The Jamie Lee Curtis thing is obvious, like, oh, well, scary movies and stuff.
Right. No, I think it works better with being Carrie Fisher. And I love when she's going to Courtney Cox and she's like, you want me to tell you who you look like?
Yeah.
So you can tell she was going to say Courtney Cox, I'm sure.
It's an Ocean's 11 thing, Brandon. It's like, yes. Oh my God, it's Julia Roberts.
Yes.
So.
Yes.
And then Wes Craven was briefly considered for the role of John Milton. But that went, of course, to Lance Henriksen, who we knew from the first Terminator and Aliens.
He was just finished up his work on Millennium.
That's right. But Wes Craven does appear in the movie as a tourist, a little cameo. He's walking behind Jay and Silent Bob outside the set of Stab 3.
That is the craziest cameo in cinematic history, having Jay and Silent Bob in this movie.
Why are they
nuts.
In this, Brandon?
I have no idea. Please, I hope you know.
I do not. I was going to ask you.
That is insane that they are in this. Like,
I guess they were fans, and you know, Kevin Smith is a big, you know, movie guy, obviously, and maybe he asked Wes Craven if they could just for them to be in it as their characters and have dialogue.
I know,
right? And they think Gale is Connie Chung.
That's the best scene in the movie, man. I love that scene so much. That is so insane.
Oh, man. So, Lee Schreiber, who returns again, I was like, wow, they're keeping this Cotton thing going, because it is funny, because at the end of the second one, right, she's like, Cotton's the hero, go talk to him, and he's like, well, it'll make a hell of a movie, and I assume that's what Stab 2 was, and now we're on Stab 3.
Right.
Okay. Because the Stab 3 thing, like, I was like, what happened to Stab... What happens to Tab 2? Like, you're supposed to be one movie behind every time, but I guess they just wanted to do this whole new... This would not have worked with the plot of the second one, obviously.
Yes.
So, so he's back. I didn't expect him to be all three of these movies.
No.
Like, oh, wow, he's in all these. Because he's, you know, he was Sabretooth in the X-Men movies. He does a lot of voiceover work. You would never know. But he does, like, there's an HBO show called Hard Knocks, which talks about the NFL in the preseason, and he's the voice of that. Like, he's the narrator. And I'm like, wow, Lee Schreiber. Like, and anyway, he has a great voice for all these documentaries. You probably heard him narrate something you've seen. You just don't know it. But,
okay, so let me ask you then. So with him showing up as the first character, did you know right away that he was going to die?
At this point, yes. This is the pattern. Like, yeah, but okay. But having an established character is new.
Yes.
Like, it's not just total strangers or something. Like, this is him. And he's become like a hot shock jock.
That's so weird. That is such a weird thing.
Bizarre. Yeah. But anyway, he insisted that he remove his jacket in the opening sequence because he'd been working out a lot and wanted to show off his physique. So good for you. Good for you, Leif. There you go. And now, hey, throughout the film, Sydney is wearing the Greek letters that Derek, her boyfriend, Jerry O'Connell, gave her in the last movie. I was wondering if there was going to happen. I was like, you know what? I bet she's not wearing this necklace. But, like, she's wearing the Greek necklace, and I really appreciate that attention to detail.
I didn't notice that. That's amazing. This movie's the best in the franchise.
We'll talk about it. So all the sets for Stab 3 were replicas of the original because they destroyed all the sets from Scream. Which is odd. You think they immediately went into production on the sequel. You think they might keep around those sets. I know it was a different location, but it's just odd they immediately destroyed them. But everything is a reproduction. And the house used during the climax of this film, where most of the killings take place, that was the same house used as the school in Halloween H2O. So, a lot of crossover here. Yeah.
Okay. Well, Halloween H2O is better than this movie.
Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah, I think you're right. Now, Jenny McCarthy complains that in the Stab 3 script, her character Candy only has two scenes before she's killed, and guess what? Her character in the real world in this movie is killed after two scenes, so I thought that was pretty clever. And she's the one that breaks the statue. That was so funny.
Right. Tried to tape it.
Oh, man.
You don't think there's a message?
And again, this is they reference like the real life of like Courtney Cox and all the Friends people because Gail makes a comment that Jennifer Jolie was in a relationship with Brad Pitt. And it's interesting that Jennifer Aniston and Angelina Jolie, who this character's name after, they were both married to Brad Pitt after this film came out. So
that's funny.
Strange serendipity, I guess. Now, this is the only film so far, anyway, that has Ghostface using a voice changer to imitate other people's voices.
Yeah.
What did you think about this? Because apparently people didn't like that it was like too sci-fi.
I loved it because I think that it is the way to take the movie to the next level because you've got now you're like anybody's a suspect at any time because you don't know whose voice it is. And, you know, like for me, the opening sequence with Liv Schreiber there, right, where she thinks it's him because of the voice. I don't know. I love it. It puts you off as a viewer. You don't know what's coming. You don't know who to expect. You don't know to trust anything on the phone. Nothing's trustworthy in this movie. And that's what I like about it.
I thought them having his voice made sense because he was this TV personality. So there's like endless voice clips of him that you could use, like some software to replicate his voice. When they started getting other people's voices, though, I was like, eh. Like, I thought they were being clever. Like, oh, because he's the shock jock guy, TV host, that's why they could replicate his voice. But then he started doing it for everyone. I was like, oh, well, that's not how the force works, but that's fine. Now, Jamie Kennedy comes back as Randy, right?
Yes!
There was initial idea. He's my favorite character. I was happy to see him, although he was basically like Leonard Nimoy in Star Trek Into Darkness. Mm-hmm. Like, he's on a screen. He's all this exposition that really you didn't need, but it was good to see him. Now, the original idea for him was that Randy was going to have survived Scream 2, and his family rescued him secretly, but that was ultimately deemed too far-fetched, and so they decided to just have him leave a video message, which is for the best because there's enough ridiculousness going on here. And that would have, like, that was a big moment of Scream 2, and just to undercut that would have been lame. Now, and it makes sense that he would record this video, so, like, I buy this guy would do this, right? Mm-hmm. And he even mentions the events of the last movie. He was like, hey, hopefully I survive this, but if you're watching this, I'm already dead. Right. now, he filmed 2 hours of footage for this 3-minute scene. Because the script was constantly changing. They wanted to cover all their bases. So in the raw footage, it was like 2 hours of him talking, and they just, you know, edited together what they needed to fit whatever the script ended up being at the time. And according to Wes Craven, in the commentary of the film, Angelina, who was the actress playing Sydney in the movie, was going to be the second killer, as Roman's girlfriend and an ex-classmate of Sydney from the first movie, but the producers, they axed that idea. They didn't like it. So I thought she might have been involved. I thought she might have been involved a couple times because, like, the house blows up and she's, like, away from everybody else. And then especially the scene where she's in the bathroom and has the mask. I was like, oh, she's definitely involved. But I guess she wasn't.
Nope, she wasn't.
There was only one killer this time. That was her twist.
There was. And that's the twist. That's what keeps you on your toes. You don't know what's going on. You don't know what's happening. Does it always have to have two killers?
What are the rules of a trilogy?
You got to amp it up. You got to have some previously unknown backstory.
The Randy scene is kind of on the nose, but it is accurate.
Right.
It's totally accurate.
So, I don't know. Have you got more trivia, or is that it?
I have a little more trivia here. We'll jump into that. Let me finish this up. At what point, the other detective was going to be one of the killers?
Oh, boy.
Not Patrick Dempsey, but the other one, Detective Wallace. And I thought for sure Kincaid, Patrick Dempsey's character, he was one of them. Like, I was so certain that he was one of them. But he was not. There were different endings about his fate. They weren't sure if they were going to kill him or not. And they realized that they never really concluded his character, so that's why they included him in that coda scene there at the end. Like, hey, we're watching a movie. Kind of give his character some resolution.
Speaking of that coda scene, like, it's nice to see that she's finally got some closure in her life, Sydney, and that she's, like, not so worried about locking her doors all the time. But
close your door.
She lives in the woods. You're going to get mosquitoes in the house. Yeah. Like, come on, close
that's
the door.
That's just mosquitoes, leaves, bears, deer.
Bears are
going to
walk in your house. Like,
your dog is going to get out. Like, close your, like, I'm all about empowerment and feeling free, but close your door.
Close your door.
Close your door. It's fine to leave your gate open, but close your door. So Wes Craven apparently filmed 3 different endings to this movie, and he didn't tell the cast which one he was going to use, which is referenced them talking about Stab 3, where it's like, oh, there's 3 different scripts, which one do they use? They're getting new pages all the time. I thought that was pretty clever. Mm-hmm. But yeah, this film never had a public test screening. The cast and crew only saw it for the first time at the premiere because they didn't want all the spoiler problems they had with the second film. So. And this set a record for the number of theaters it opened in 2000. This was 3,467 theaters. Wow. But then the next year, it was surpassed by Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone, which was the first Harry Potter movie, which was 3,762. So
how much was the two of them? What were the numbers?
3,467 screens for Scream 3, and then the next year, Harry Potter 1 had 3,762.
Oh, it's like 300 screens more.
Yeah, wow. There you go. I'm sure Scream 4 overtook it, though, right? We'll keep an eye on that, right?
We'll figure that out.
Now, there is an awkwardness about this film, because it's produced by the Weinsteins, mm-hmm. right? Mm. And there's, like, the whole subplot here about, you know, sexual predator Hollywood producers and actresses and all this stuff, and they're like, oh, it was a different time, or like, even like, you know, the Carrie Fisher scene, the Lance Henderson scene, like all that stuff. And I was like, oh, this is the actress is talking about, like, that's the last time I sleep with so and so. I'm like, oh, this is kind of awkward knowing that Harvey Weinstein, like, it's played for kind of laughs and like, hey, Hollywood being what it is, right? Mm-hmm. In the movie, but like, no, Harvey Weinstein was producing this movie, and he is a very notorious figure in the Me Too movement, so it is kind of awkward knowing who made this movie and then making these jokes, right?
See, like, it is awkward, but I don't know, I applaud the movie for, like, addressing it well before it was addressed in the general public, I think. Like, it was always this thing that people, like, made jokes about or whatnot. Like, you remember the Toy Story 2 deleted. Like, they had a gag reel on their DVD.
Kelsey Grammer, yeah.
Right, and that's now since been deleted or whatnot, where Stinky Pete is, like, talking to some Barbies. He's like, you guys want to roll in the movie? Come on with me over here. You know, like, that's in a kid's movie. Right, a gag reel for a kid's DVD, right? Like, but to address it in this and make it a plot of the movie, it's uncomfortable, but I appreciate it.
And it isn't like throwaway stuff. I mean, some of it is jokes, right? Like the Carrie Fisher thing. But I mean, the plot of the mom having the kid and the, like, that is essential to the plot. So
it's dark.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But so. That's what I got. So you want to jump into the discussion here?
Yeah, let's do it. So, okay, so let's start with Liv Schreiber right at the beginning here. So what do you think of Cotton dying right off at the bat? So we got an established character this time.
So I liked how he was back, like, again, tying the continuity with all the characters. And it's funny, like, I when I saw the first one, I'm like, oh, that's cool, Lee Schreiber. He's like some face on a TV. I didn't know he was involved in these, and now he's like a character now in mm-hmm. these three movies. I had no idea. Side note, you know, I should have mentioned this last time, but when Scream 2 came out, he replaced, okay, so Scream 2, the poster, right?
Mm-hmm.
Lee Schreiber was not on it. Jerry O'Connell was. But now, if you like look at the box on like the DVD or something, Lee Schreiber has replaced Jerry O'Connell on the poster because he's a bigger star now than, you know. So Sliders is well behind us now, and Lee Schreiber's kind of a bigger name. So anyway, that reminded me of that when she brought him up. But I thought that was an effective way to continue the pattern of them having a prologue. And it was a pretty tense scene, you know, because it starts out, like all these, they start out kind of innocent, you know, and then they just flip a switch and it's like a thriller all of a sudden. I really enjoyed that. Although there's no way he would have made it home in that traffic, driving against traffic. There's no way.
Right. I don't know LA traffic, but I'm guessing it's a little bit busy. So.
And like you were saying in the trivia, it was effective that like the voice changer is what really turned his girlfriend against him, which ended up dooming them both. So.
Right. But then also like, so with the voice changer, right? So he's pretending to be on the phone with this woman, right? And then it's the killer. Right off the bat. So even there, it's not just the killer's voice right from the beginning. And so as the viewer, you're caught off guard right from the beginning,
mm-hmm.
which I appreciate. I like that a lot. So.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's... Here we go. One of the most fascinating types of filmmaking is a film about movie making. So like while they've been addressing movies in general, we've now got to a movie about making a movie.
They've gone the step further. Like the second one was like, hey, they made a movie about the first one. Here it is. Mm-hmm. And now it's like, we were making a movie about mm-hmm. all this stuff. And you know what's funny is, I don't even think they really addressed it, but like this being Stab 3, which I'm like, it should have been Stab 2. They've gone where like, they have no source material now, which I thought is kind of interesting as well. Because what are they basing this off of? But I think...
But that's what I like about it, because they're making up the movies, the quote-unquote stabbing movie, like the killer, is making up the movie as he goes along. You know, they don't have to follow anything. It's not predictable. Mm-hmm. Okay, they're killing them in the order they get killed in the movie. He's trying to end the movie from being made and whatnot, right?
Right.
But it's like the movie's being made as they go, rather than the movie being based on the life. Now life is being made on the movie. Meta.
I get it.
It's awesome.
Look, these movies do what The Matrix Resurrections tried to do, and they do it much better. You know what I mean?
This is better than Matrix Resurrections.
1,000%. Like, there's this 1,000% better. But, yeah, I mean, I don't know. It was a little more convoluted than the last couple, you know? I mean, you talk about the motivations of, you know, the Billy's mom and the first. I'm like, okay, but, you know, revenge, some crazy film student thinks he's Tarantino deal. I'm like, okay, mm-hmm. I can roll with that. But it's like, how many times can these things happen at this point, right? And so I guess put a pin in that.
Well, at least two more times.
Yeah, apparently this. So. Put a pin in that. Let's talk about the video message, because all the stuff that Randy says is 100% accurate about trilogies, right?
Okay, do you have it written down there? Because I don't remember exactly. I remember him talking about, like, a backstory that's not known, like, a truth that was...
You revisit the beginning?
Yes.
Yeah, so, I mean, all that sort of thing is there. And then all bets are off, right?
Yes.
And they really wanted to make you think Sidney was going to die in this.
Yes.
But they planted enough seeds with, like, the bulletproof jackets and stuff. I was like, all right, I'll allow it. But it is true, and I was thinking about it. I mean, all the things he was saying, I was like, that does apply to a lot of trilogies. Because what do you do, right? Because you do a sequel, you do it, the second one is like, we're going to do new ground or whatever, right? And then when you don't just copy the first one, which a lot of ones do. And the third one is usually like, let's revisit, right? The stuff from the first one, right? And let's, because you want to end where you began and all that stuff. I mean, Star Wars does it, Indiana Jones, you know, I would say Back to the Future, but every movie kind of revisits everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yep.
In Back to the Future. There's not many trilogies. We've been finding this out. There's not many trilogies anymore.
Yeah, trilogy used to be the thing, and then now four was the thing, it seemed like, right?
Well, it was like a trilogy and like a years later sequel, like which Scream will have after this.
Right.
But then now it's like just endless reboots, franchise. I mean, that's why we're here, right? But trilogies, they're not that many trilogies anymore, just because of the way franchises are.
Right. Like Alien 3 was a trilogy for a while, right? Alien was a trilogy for a while. Like, you know, I don't know. It seemed like 3 was like a nice round number. But we're going beyond that now. We're going beyond into fours and fives and sixes and whatnot. So, so the Hollywood aspect of this, you didn't like this. You didn't like this aspect of it in Stab 3.
Yeah, no, it was okay. No, they do joke about the recasting. Like, oh, now I know why Tori Spelling didn't want to come back. You know, that is like there is some commentary there, and it does. Much like the film premiere of number 2 had all these Ghostface costumes, the fact that there were all these Ghostface costumes in the set was helpful. You know, then when they're in the wardrobe room and like one of the costumes moves, you're like, oh, that's pretty cool. So, I mean, it's pretty cool. I don't like the idea is okay, but where it all falls apart for me, and I didn't hate this or anything, I just didn't like it as much as the first two, is that it's her secret brother. Like, that's the entire motivation. And then not only that, but he's set. In, like, he's set in motion the events of the first couple of movies because he showed the video of Billy's dad and Sydney's mom to him and then set him off and all this stuff. And that, to me, that's like Blofeld. And have you seen the new James Bond movies, the Daniel Craig?
I've seen some of them once. I haven't seen the last one, like the one that's in theaters now. But
so the one before the last one, Spectre. Okay. Yeah. Like, turns out Blofeld is James Bond's, you know, adoptive brother or whatever, and he's like, it was me, James, the author of all your pain. And you're like, look, the last three movies were all because of stuff I did. I was like, okay, that's lame. And it's lame here too. Like, that was a step too far, I think. You know, the secret sibling,
that's the thing that they do, though. I mean, like, that's how they do it. They reinvent the third movie. They reinvent what you've seen before. So, like, it's a trope, but this movie is all about tropes. So it doesn't bother me that it's in there because it's playing it. You're talking about the recasting of the characters. Well, that's what happens when you get to the third movie, usually.
That is fun, though. I like that part. That was,
you know, like, they're dealing with all the tropes of the horror franchise and franchises in general. And this movie is tongue-in-cheek the whole way through. So none of those things bother me because it's playing with those tropes.
Maybe so. And, you know, you get Roger Corman in there as a little cameo talking about violence in movies. That was fun. But I don't know. This is one that, like, the last two, I'm like, I love these. These are great. This one was like, it felt different. I'd be curious if rewatching what I would think, kind of knowing what was coming. Because that kind of major retcon is kind of annoying to me, but it's like, it was intentional. You know, it was supposed to be. I'm like, okay, maybe. I mean, they had, you know, they going back to her mom, who makes sense, but I just don't know who wanted to. Like, it could have been, like, okay, it could have been the movie producer. Like, he's a good suspect. The detective is a really good suspect. I thought for sure Patrick Dempsey, Kincaid, was one of the killers. You know, again, thinking there were always two, because the other two movies had them.
Yeah.
But they changed it this time, there's just the one. And then it got to the end, and I was like, oh, I guess it is just the one killer, I guess. But I don't like I guess Patrick Dempsey's character, he was just obsessed with Sydney or something, or what's his deal? Like,
well, he's obsessed with murder and stuff in Hollywood, right? Because that's his thing. He's like, whenever things that are ever involved in the business are me, you know, like they come to me all the time.
Yeah. Well, so. And then, you know, I think they set him up as the killer pretty good, like, as far as, like, he leaves and, you know, she gets the call, or like he's the one, like, we have to find out where she is and that kind of thing. So I think, I don't know, like, it was almost not fulfilling when he wasn't the killer, because there was so much evidence that he would have been. Or even Lance Henriksen, you know, was at his mansion, right? All that stuff was going down. And I thought for a minute, I'm like, is Roman, like, his son or something?
That's what I was thinking. Like, that's kind of my retcon on it, is that he is his son or something like that. I don't know who would have raised him or whatnot, but.
Right, because he's like, hey, we're having a birthday party for you at my house, kind of thing. Like, I feel like they should have added that layer in there. But then it makes, because I guess they don't want to make who his dad is, like, a thing. Like, it was just that horrible party that happened, and they don't know who his dad is, I guess. That's part of the
Harvey Weinstein's his dad.
I guess so.
It's like, I don't know. So, the one character that, like, felt weird to me in this one is Dewey. Right? The fact that he's, like, a technical consultant on this film feels out of character.
It's just an excuse for him to be in the film.
Right.
Well, and then the thing, they do the same thing that they did the second movie with him and Gale, where it's like...
Again, it's just the same thing.
Are we doing this every movie? Are they going to break up and be divorced before Scream 4 and get back together? I hope not. We'll see. So I haven't watched Scream 4 yet, so... But
we'll get there.
The same beats of like, they're like, hey, you wrote bad stuff about me. I don't trust you. I'm like, oh, I'm not so bad. I'm sorry, Dewey. And they have a little friction at the beginning, and they end up, you know, making up in the middle. And they have this whole, like you were saying in the last conversation, they're the weirdest couple ever.
Yeah.
Like, they apparently had a relationship for a few years in between movies, and we just didn't see it. And now they're like, that's the only reason you can buy, like, him proposing her at the end, because they had this lease history.
Right.
And I guess he got better. Like, there's like a line. She's like, and I waited around for you to get better. And he is a little less crippled in this one, isn't he?
Yes.
So but I guess his second injury helped heal his first one.
Yeah. Yes. I guess it must have. They must have canceled each other out a little bit there, so. But yeah, so Dewey felt a little bit odd for me in this one here. Like, this is, I don't think this is by any means, like, as good as the first one, this one here. But, you know, I still like it a lot, and I think it's a lot of fun playing on the tropes of the trilogy and whatnot. I don't know, I love the aspect of it being, of filming and being on a set and whatnot. And I liked Sydney's character, like, trying to take power and help other, you know, women.
I like
in
that
a situation,
yeah.
Right?
That's what someone like that would do in that situation if they wanted to, like, make a difference and make it all not for nothing, right?
Yeah. That she's like, how can I take my pain and help somebody else through a problem? That worked for me a lot. I thought that was pretty creative.
Yeah, and the crisis hotline is smart. Her working on a phone is smart. So when, you know, Ghostface does call her, you know, and she looks at, oh, I'm not on the office line, I'm on the home line, and he found
that's
me and
a
stuff.
Yeah, that's a good twist.
It's a good. And she has a dog, which is smart. You know, like, you know, things to, like, keep you, you know, safer or whatever. But oh, so this is a bit of trivia here. You know who the voice of one of the callers is, Brandon?
No.
Beth Toussaint. I don't know if I'm pronouncing your name right, but she played Ishara Yar in Next Generation, Josh's sister. Okay. She's okay. One of the people that calls in the crisis hotline. So
that's funny.
But no, the character progression works for her. And then, you know, her dad comes and visits her. And I was thinking, like, who is left to be villains, or what is left in these stories, right? I thought maybe her dad snapped at some point, like, and would have been a villain in Scream 3. Mm-hmm. Just because, like, you're running out of characters. Because you're certainly not just going to invent characters out of nowhere. They've been here all along. Oh, wait, you are. So
yes.
That's what you did. But I do miss her in being in the film more.
Yes, because she is the central force of the series, you know, and so it is kind of odd that she's not there. But, I mean, I guess you got a real-world explanation for it. She's busy on other stuff. And, I mean, you can't be doing 7 days a week forever.
Right.
Right.
And that's why they keep elevating Gale and Dewey's characters, right? And then add these extra... Like, I don't think you needed all these extra actor characters. Like, they're basically just, like, there to be killed and be potential suspects, I guess. But... I don't like in the other movies, like, I just feel like everybody kind of had a role, and, like, this time it was just kind of crowded.
Did you like Parker Posey in this as Gale?
I did like Parker Posey as Jennifer as Gale, you know. Yes. They end up, like, you know, they don't like each other at first, but they end up, like, kind of liking each other. And I felt bad when she died.
Yes.
You know? And that's Roman killing everyone. So he, what was his deal? Like, he faked that he was killed in that casket, or what?
No, he was pretending.
So he was just laying there like I'd been killed or something, you think?
Right, because we had the scene afterwards, right? Because he was there at the end.
Well, no, I know that. I'm just saying, like, when there's only one killer, it's harder to fake stuff like this.
Yes.
So.
I'm just saying,
like the fact there was only one this time around... It, like, you're like, how did one person do all this? When there's two, you can, like, okay, well, somebody else is doing this, why somebody else is doing that? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So,
right. Okay, yeah.
The omnipresence-ness of the villain, of the ghost
but
face.
Even in the last one, though, like, I don't know, my interpretation of the last one is that Timothy Olyphant's character did everything by himself. Right? I don't think that...
But he could have done it without a partner. That's what he says.
But I don't think she did much, though. That's the thing. I think she just got him to do everything, right?
Yeah.
So...
That is something about the last one. Like, that is a bad, like, that is, I feel so bad for Jerry O'Connell in that last one, because she's like gonna untie him. He's like, hey, come on, untie me. He's like, oh, hey, we got her. It's cool, man. Like, he's totally playing like they got her. It was the same ending of the first one. He's like, she's getting a little deja vu. So that I'm glad they didn't do the same thing again this time. Like, she, like, Sydney doesn't have a boyfriend, you know, it's all just she's on her own. Like, I like that. So it is very different. So to their credit, like, they didn't just try to replicate, you know, this is a very just metatextual examination of what sequels do and can be. And so I get that. I just didn't connect with it as well. I could tell even without reading the trivia, I'm like, this one's a little softer than the other two. You know, it's a little more cheeky. Got Putty from Seinfeld in here, Patrick Warburton. You know, you might know him from the Advantage Rent-A-Car commercials these days. I think that's
Family Guy. He's Joe Swanson.
He's Joe, right? Yeah. So it's like, I'm like, okay, he's here. He's a joke. So I don't know. It just wasn't as earnest as maybe the other two. I guess there was just something. It wasn't. It didn't like, you know. It felt still in line, but I could feel it drifting away from what the first two were as far as like the tone was.
Yeah.
So that's where I pick up on it there. And there's no Randy other than his videotape and his random sister. Talk about secret siblings. Randy has a sister that was just there with a videotape. That's kind of convenient, isn't it?
Well, there you go. Now you can't complain because other characters have random siblings who didn't
This is what you do in fiction. So
yes.
Introduce random siblings that we never heard of before to keep the story going.
Yeah. Why not?
For all the complaints I have, I do think, like I said, like they did have a pretty good list of suspects.
Mm-hmm.
Again, they were all like reasonable. Like, but I didn't like the director guy, period.
So explain on that why you just didn't like him at all.
I didn't like his vibe. Like I felt like he was just a very sanitized version of these characters we've seen in the other films. Like I don't know, he's just kind of annoying. And I was like, good, he's dead. Let's be done with him. And he ends up being the killer. I'm like, oh, come on. Like Benicio del Toro, I thought would have brought something to it other than, you know, this guy. Mm-hmm. I think he's in Felicity, the TV show. So again, okay. He's like a WB actor they brought in here. So it's the same as everybody else where they come from. I guess I didn't watch that show. Ever. If it was somebody like, Joshua Jackson, I'd be much more excited. Because
I just can't
no picture
Benicio del Toro as a long lost brother.
I don't know. Older brother, clearly. So, and then, yeah, her mom having this whole history in Hollywood. I'm like, okay, sure. People, you know. In the 70s, you could get away with that, like going off the grid for a few years and stuff. You know, and that was in a compelling mystery, like where are these pictures coming from and that kind of thing. So that was fun, but I don't know. Like if they had just not done the whole like, and I'm the one that showed your ex-boyfriend your mom cheating with his dad kind of thing, right? That was a step too far as the retconning goes.
I guess I can get that. I guess
it's
I can understand.
Have the secret sibling, but don't be like, oh, and nothing else would have happened without me either.
Yeah.
So, that's my deal.
Okay, that's fair. That's fair. So,
It is, I mean, he even, like, to get back to the tape, you know, Randy's tape, he was like, all bets are off this time. This guy, he's unkillable, right? You know, he's going to be, like, knives, guns, they're not going to be effective. Like, at the end, they basically shoot him, you know, Ghostface this time, her brother, half-brother. And then he gets up at the end to stab him again, and they have to shoot him in the head to kill him. Like, that was that was almost parody-ish. That's the kind
funny.
Of thing that the first two movies would make fun of or being dumb.
Yeah.
Like, if Jada Pinkett Smith was sitting here watching the movie, she'd be calling it out like she was in the second movie.
In the second one. But that's okay, because it's addressing, like, that sequels do that. The sequels do the things that are like, okay, that's kind of...
So you're picking up where they're putting down more than me, basically, is what...
I think so, yeah.
Okay. That's fair.
I think I like the self-referentialness of it, and I appreciate them acknowledging the silliness of franchises in general and just... calling it right out by putting it right into the script. So it works for me.
I guess it's a fine line of like, are they doing it intentionally? Are they doing it because they're lazy? So I'm not so sure where those lines are. But I guess I will say kind of wrap it up here. Probably my favorite sequence was the sequence on the set where Sydney's running away from Ghostface in the same sets that we saw in the first movie. I thought that was really cool.
Yeah, and the door was the bedroom door. Was
the door, and then he just falls out and goes onto the bed.
Yeah. No, I meant like in her bedroom with the closet, right?
Oh, yeah. So, it was like, exactly the same where the door couldn't get through and stuff. Throwing the stuff down the stairs. Like, that was obviously the same kind of thing that happened in the first one. And then seeing something that we never saw before, which is really creepy, the crime scene with her mom being dead.
Mm-hmm.
And that was pretty creepy. So,
yeah.
And then, you know, I don't think we've seen Ghostface talk much with the voice changer. And we saw it a lot in this one, like as far as like in the costume talking.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because he's like his whole monologue to Sydney about like her mom and stuff at the end. It's him standing there in the costume with the voice changer, and usually you either see one or the other, or it's like, you know, for 2 seconds. So I thought that was pretty, to kind of connect the voice with the face like that was kind of cool. So, mm-hmm. So yeah.
Excellent. Right on. Awesome. Well, you get some questions for me, Zach?
I do. Let's start with, what is our phone call count?
I'm going to go with 10 again.
That's what I have is 2.
Okay.
So I have Cotton in the car. Right. Okay. The crisis counseling, Candy at the studio, you know, from the director. And it really was the director. Yes. That was like trying to be some twist. They mentioned like duplicate cell phones or something at some point. I didn't know what they were
cloning
talking about,
cell
but
phones,
cloning. Yeah. What is so this late 90s, early 2000s technology, but,
cell phones are new, man. You can do anything with them.
Right. the next crisis counseling call, that she gets, the bodyguard, getting the phone call, Joe from Family Guy, as you said. He'll always be Putty from Seinfeld to me, though. Dewey in the car. Dewey in the house. Sydney at the police station. And then Sydney at the house. And there's that one final one at the end where they're like calling each other. So that would be 10. Although there's one phone call that we never see, actually, Brandon. I didn't count it because we didn't see it. But when Ghostface calls her and she's at the station, he's like, okay, I'm gonna let you know where you're going when you're on your way. And like, clearly he would have called her when they were in the car. And then when she gets out of the car, he's like, you follow directions well. Like,
yes,
you know. And so that's 10 total, which brings us to 31 so far, Brandon.
31. That's a lot.
So it looks like I found a good trope this time.
Yeah, more than the lawgiver count.
Real quick, though, that reminded me. I thought that was pretty smart that when she showed up at the mansion at the end, he had the metal detector. He was like,
yes.
Scan yourself at the metal detector. Like, that's really smart.
Yes.
And but she still had a second gun. So
yeah, that's because she's smart.
That's right. So that she's consistent. You know, if one of these, we mentioned some of the other characters, or even the tone maybe floating around, but she is consistent.
Mm-hmm.
And she's on her way to probably being my favorite final girl in these movies at this point. Because it was, you know, I hadn't seen these before. So it was always, you know, Laurie Strode before now. And now it's Sydney Prescott. So
yeah, there you go. Right on. Excellent. So how many out of 5 phone calls would you give this?
I would let it ring 3 times. 3 out of 5 for this.
Okay.
It's a strong 3, but still a 3 because it's a definite step down from the first 2 in my book.
Mm-hmm.
So 3 out of 5 for me. What about you, Brendan?
Yeah, if I was given halves, it'd probably still be 3.5, but I don't think it's a 3, so I'm going to give it 4. 4
okay.
As well. Yeah, I'm going to give it a 4. So it's good. I like it.
Farron, it's interesting. So like, you are a big fan of this franchise.
Yeah, you know, I like these ones.
And I have never seen these before. And we feel pretty differently about the 2 and 3. So I think that's pretty interesting. So
Yeah. You know what? I think I'm in the minority for not liking 2. And I think I'm in the minority for liking 3 as much as I do. So I think I'm the weird one here.
Fair enough. I mean, that much is certain. So
So now, would you say this franchise is fatigued?
You know, honestly, at this point, yes.
Okay.
Because, I mean, they even make a big deal about this is the big finale, right? You know, and I even though I never saw this back in the day, right? I remember the trailer where she's like, what do you know about trilogies? He's like, all bets are off. Like, I remember that. And yeah, this is it. Like, they pull out all the stops. Like, they've gone down every conceivable angle or avenue they could have to continue this. She kind of has a nice ending, right? We joked about leaving the door open, but like there was a big thing that like she had a gate and a security code and all this stuff. And like, I liked how like showed her progress at the end, but still close your doors, people.
Close your doors. Come on.
And then, you know, Dewey and Gail are getting married now, you know, and that was cute. He's like, signed this book and it was an engagement ring in there. That was pretty smart. So it feels like, and everyone else is dead who you cared about, right? And now she's going to go watch a movie. I assume a scary movie. That's the cliffhanger. Which movie did they watch?
Stab 4.
That's the shit. That was random, but whatever. But no, I feel like if this was kind of closed out well. Like, even though I didn't like love this, like the first time, like, okay, I feel like this was a closing chapter here. And I'm going to say yes, because I'm really curious, knowing that not only is there one, but there's 2 more after this.
Yeah.
I have no idea what they're going to do. And I haven't seen it yet, so I'm excited but also nervous to see where they go with this. So I'm going to say yes, it is fatigued.
I would agree, because I think that this is a good trilogy, and they set it up that way. You feel like it was designed to be a trilogy. I'm content with this being 3, so I'm going to say yes. Because there's no way that any trilogy would ever become four.
No. When has that worked?
Never.
Never.
Never. So anyways, excellent. Awesome. Zach, where can people find you when you're not setting up secret rooms in the basement of your mansion?
Well, you can find me personally on Twitter at MoronZach. That's MoronZach. I'm also the host of another podcast here on the network, Sasquatch, where Ken Tripp and I talk about the multimedia phenomenon of Bigfoot. It's a fun and lighthearted look at movies, TV shows, documentaries, books about Sasquatch. And you can find us on Twitter at SasquatchPod. And, of course, I host Always Alone in Smallville, where we talk about each and every episode of that Young Superman show. You can find us on Twitter at Always Smallville with one S on Twitter, which I said twice. So, Brandon, when you aren't hosting a number one nationally syndicated talk show, where can people find you?
You can find me on Twitter at Brandon Metella. You can find me here on the network with a show called Infinite Diversity, which is all about new Star Trek. I also have a show called Good Evening, an Alfred Hitchcock podcast, which covers Hitch's films in chronological order. Thank you so much to Tony Robinson for the show art. Thank you so much to Zach Tripp for our wonderful theme music. You can find our show on Twitter at Franchise Fatigue. You can send us an email, franchisefatigue@ufp.earth. You can find the network on Twitter at UFPEarth. And thank you so much to the executive producers of the network, Ken Tripp and Tony Robinson. Thank you so much to our associate producers of the show, David Willett and Casey Pettit. Thank you so much for supporting us as well as the network on a whole. And yeah, I guess that's all we got for you now. Until next time when we cover Scream 4.
Well, there's a fourth one?
There is a fourth one, and there's going to be a fifth one too, man. Just see, spoilers. Man. Spoilers. So until then, what's your favorite scary movie?
My life.
This has been a production of MTMR Media Works.